Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and welcome to our UFO program. We open it with a sad note. Bud Hopkins has passed away. He was 80 years old, born June 15th back in 1931, and died August 21st, 2011. We have a note here that I'm going to read, and it's from Leslie Kane. She says, "I'm very sad to announce that Bud Hopkins died August 21st at 1:35 p.m. Bud had been under hospice care for about 3 weeks. He was at his home in New York. The combination of liver cancer and pneumonia led to his death. His daughter, Grace Hopkins Lessel, and I were with him almost continuously during the last 3 weeks. He was not in any pain, and he received the best possible care and loving support from those closest to him." She wrote this late on Sunday. "Today, he gradually slipped away and simply, quietly stopped breathing. He died peacefully and without a struggle. Grace's husband, Andrew, and myself were at his side. Thanks to all of you for being such strong supporters of this extraordinary man who has contributed so much to our lives in so many different ways." Signed, Leslie Kane. We're going to do a little salute, a tribute to Bud Hopkins. We're going to play some of the interviews we've done with him over the years. And we're going to start with one that we did at Sunset Station in Las Vegas. And it was back in 2004, maybe 2003 even, and I can remember it as clear as today. Bud came running up to the table and said, "I've got about 30 minutes here. Let's do an interview." So we did. It only lasted about 18 minutes, but it was a very informational interview, especially at the time. He talked about something that I was not even aware of. And I thought I knew almost everything about New Mexico UFO crashes. So let's listen to that interview, and you'll see what I'm talking about. The late, great Bud Hopkins. And we have Bud Hopkins with us, and Bud, your new book is going places.
Well, it's called Sight Unseen, and it's the first book I've written in a lot of years. I've written 4 books in 28 years, so I'm not exactly a prolific writer. But I never write anything until I have some new material that has never been made part of the public record, really, in terms of aspects of the abduction phenomenon haven't been studied.
Yeah, Larry Dickin, our UFO producer, went over to Staten Island when you unveiled the book, and you actually wrote this in cooperation with your wife, correct?
Right. Carol Rainey, my wife, is a filmmaker and a writer, and she had no interest in the subject of UFOs when we first met, and she began doing very careful research and going back into the history of the phenomenon, reading Donald Kehoe and, you know, all the early writers and so forth, and got totally fascinated. And she was a filmmaker who had done a lot of medical films and science films for the New England Research Institute. So she started getting interested in the science that's going on today in our culture that is somehow similar to the kinds of science that apparently the UFO occupants can carry out. And so what it turns out is that the distance between alien science and human science is shrinking. So what we're really trying to do with this book is to take the para out of paranormal.
And it's an incredible read. But now, you talked about something here at this conference, here in Las Vegas, that I was not aware of at all, and that was an Albuquerque crash of what, 1963, of a UFO.
Right. I'm not a...
this is different from what you've been doing.
Right.
You know, my first question, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but my first question is, how come you got interested in this?
Yeah. Interested in this particular...
Yes,
Well, this case sort of fell into my lap, Jerry. It was really a situation where a woman I'd worked with who'd had abduction experiences befriended this elderly lady at a conference, at a MUFON meeting, and this woman happened to tell her about this weird experience she had had. That's why she finally decided to seek out the MUFON or something. And when she told this woman friend of hers about the fact that she had actually handled three alien bodies as a medical technician in a small hospital, this particular friend of mine, who she was talking to, called me right away and said, "But I think you ought to give this lady a call and get into this case." So I looked into it just because it sort of fell into my lap.
Now, to give a little background, the crash happened near Albuquerque. The state police were even involved.
Right. This happened in 1963, and the background is that this medical technician worked at a very small hospital in a town probably 90 miles from Albuquerque. And as a medical technician, part of her job was to ride in the ambulance to accidents and whatever illnesses. And one day they got a call that there was an accident in the location. That was all they were told by the dispatcher. And they hopped in the ambulance, went out, and found two state police cars in this field with just two state policemen, and in the background some kind of wreckage. And when they drove up and got out of the ambulance, there were three small bodies on the ground. And this woman said, the medical technician, to the police officer, "Where are their parents?" And he said, "No, there aren't any parents." He said, "I don't know what we've got here." And ultimately, she began to look at the bodies for vital signs, see if they were still living. There had been a fire in this crash. They were burnt. But when she realized that they were deceased, she began to realize these were extremely strange and basically not human beings.
They were what, the little gray type or what?
These were, well, see, the skin was outside was sort of scorched, but they were small, she thought between 3 and 4 feet tall, maybe closer to three and a half feet. They were, they had small bodies, of course, long arms, and she said they were wearing some kind of coverall thing, and she didn't know what it was, but it had an incredible hardness. They couldn't cut through it easily. They had to get a knife to get to the flesh to see if there was a pulse or anything. But the most important thing about this is that they packed up the three bodies, she did, with the driver of the ambulance, and took them back to the hospital. So here she is riding. This is the only woman I've ever heard of. I was riding in an ambulance with three alien bodies, and who was actually in charge of handling them. Takes them into the X-ray room and X-rays the bodies. And after she studies the X-rays, and the doctor is called to, and he pronounces them dead. She because she didn't think they were human. She didn't know whether there would be some vital sign that she'd missed. The doctor, only one doctor at this hospital, pronounced them dead on arrival. And within a very short time, the Air Force arrived. Now, she had already taken X-rays of all three bodies, and she said that she could get the entire torso down to into the pelvis on a 14-inch pallet, which shows that you're dealing with a very small, very small body. And so, at any rate, that they were.
Now, the Air Force showed up. Did they took the bodies, I guess.
The Air Force showed up. They had a couple of command cars. They had a flatbed truck. They went and got the wreckage from the craft, cleaned up the site. It was under tarpaulin. It was not a big object. This is fairly small. And then came back to the bodies, and they were warned, and incidentally, the bodies were taken, the X-rays were taken, her trip ticket with the information on where they...
Don't tell me, they took that too.
Every single object. She had made a couple of notes, that was taken, and the Air Force colonel said, "This never happened, you never saw this, you were never to speak about this, and remember, the government has a long arm." and they were quite frightened. Now, the other thing that's interesting is the ambulance had meanwhile been parked back in the garage where it's kept. The Air Force descended on the garage, got into the back of the ambulance, and took out every single thing they could find, sheets and whatever there was. And when I interviewed the widow of the ambulance driver, he's deceased for a number of years, she's quite elderly. She said, we were never paid for any of the things the Air Force took. We were never paid for the trip. They took our sheets. They took our stuff from the back. And, of course, the ambulance driver apparently never even told his wife about this, because I guess the warnings were so stiff that he was a little frightened to include her in this. But at least she was able to testify, and we have that on film, that the Air Force ransacked the ambulance.
Now, the interesting thing about when you came on the scene and started investigating this with this medical technician, did I understand or misunderstand? Has she had an abduction experience?
We thought that there was a possibility, but that's still very uncertain as to whether she had ever had an experience like that. But so that's a kind of a moot point at this point. Now, she was an elderly lady, and when we I would try to do some hypnosis to help her remember some more details, even the name of the officer or something that gave her the warning, and it wasn't terribly successful.
I was very interested in your medical story about in New York, where they actually have some medical evidence now of maybe an abduction.
Well, that's an extremely important case. That's the Jim Mortellaro case. And this happened over a year ago. But the basic point of that case was that this man who holds two Ph.D. degrees and is a very successful businessman, his conscious memory is that he got in his car to drive out of the garage to go to visit a friend in the hospital, and apparently a second later decided that they had forgotten something. And he pulled back into the garage a second later. And when he went into the house, his wife said, "Where have you been?" It's 11 o'clock at night, and there was a whole period of missing time. And he was feeling extremely strange, as she noticed suddenly that there was blood on the front of his trousers and on his face. And she said, "What happened to you? Were you in an accident?" And at that point, he passed out. And when he woke up, he was on the table in the emergency room. And he was bleeding from the bladder. And the doctor that was his personal physician had shown up at the hospital. And the lucky thing is that he had been talking to his doctor for several years about his suspicion that he was having abduction experiences. So the doctor was extremely interested in this. And they did the next morning, they kept him in the hospital overnight. But the next morning they did a procedure called a cystoscopy, which is to insert a viewing tube in the urethra. And they found that the bladder was severely abraded. Now, this is something that you don't do to yourself.
You're absolutely right.
This is something that's done by some external force. And the doctor, one of the doctors who spoke to me about this, said that it looked like a botched cystoscopy. That was her reading on the damage that was done. But at any rate, this was the beginning of an entire long, complex story. He could not remember where this took place, but under the control of the doctors, he was given a kind of chemical regression. They gave him a mixture of chemicals which helped him remember what happened. And he remembered the abduction and the fact that some instrument had been inserted in his urethra in the craft, and that it had been extraordinarily painful. He remembered what the creatures looked like. There was one who sort of was in charge and asked for this to be done to him, apparently, by one of the smaller grays. But this figure was a tall, praying mantis-looking creature, and which we get in numerous cases. And it's a very interesting thing, Jerry, that when you get these different physical types described, the praying mantis type, or as opposed to the regular grays, or some that are look half human and half alien. They're all cooperating at the same time, doing the same thing. So they're not. It isn't as if you have one ship with one tide coming in and doing something and another.
So they're integrated.
They're certainly integrated. Yeah. It's also not a very democratic thing because it's very hierarchical, and the small grays seem to do the schlep work, and the taller gray seems to be in charge, in this case, the praying mantis type. But at any rate, Jim could not, they didn't get into where this happened, even though he could remember the abduction and how he was taken aboard. So what happened, I did a hypnotic regression with him a little later, and he was able, under very careful questioning and procedures, to remember where he was driving, even though he was driving at that point under alien control. I mean, he didn't know why he was making a right turn at such and such a street and a left turn at such and such. But we got a complete itinerary, and subsequently, with a video cameraman in the back seat, we went to the site, found the streets are there just as he'd remembered, and drove up and found the field where he'd driven his car right off the road into a field. And there were the tire tracks showing where he drove. And there was even a piece of the underside of his car, something having to do with the air vent, that had fallen off. It was right there at the site. And he picked it up.
Well, that's a pretty good verification. Of course, the name of the new book is Sight Unseen. And we're talking with Bud Hopkins here. And Bud, one thing I have to ask you before we leave here is, it's a long time from the first time you wrote that first book about abductions and you call them transgenic beings now, right?
Well, my wife is the scientist in the group, and so she was reading the genetic experimentation that's going on. What she realized is that our idea of a hybrid, which is, you know, the way you produce a donkey or so.
Right. Well, originally we talked about that
as a hybrid, for want of a better term. It's not the precise thing that's happening. What they are doing is inserting genes of one species into another. It's not the same as a sexual mix, where you take an ovum from one species and sperm from the other. This is not what seems to be happening. When I wrote Intruders, I called introduced for the first time what is actually going on here in terms of the alien agenda to produce quote-unquote hybrid beings or transgenic beings. I call them hybrids just as a shorthand. It's kind of almost a general term nowadays. But Carol, being a stickler now from having studied the genetic issues, wanted to call them transgenic beings, so that was the term she used.
Well, I think you made the sale, because every time I start talking about the subject when we're lining up shows, Larry Dickin tells me they're not hybrids, Jerry. They're transgenic beings.
Well, that's being a careful stickler for this. But in other words, you make a hybrid in the case of a donkey, as I said, by combining a sperm and ovum from two different species. But this is not what seems to be happening. And right now, as we know,
somewhat like a gene splicing.
Yes, it's a gene splicing. And as you know now, there have been some outrageous things done where, as in the most famous case, a gene from a salmon has been inserted into a tomato plant, so tomatoes are able to bear the cold better. Now, we're going from animal to vegetable here. So the idea that when I wrote Intruders and was attacked by a lot of scientists saying this is impossible, can never happen, so on and so forth. Well, it's happening. And in a certain sense, I feel very pleased that having...
Should be vindicated.
I do. And I feel that having stuck by the data, the actual information, rather than going by the theories that were being thrown in my face, theories never trump data. And so by hanging in there with the data has proved to be supported really by the gene splicing and the engineering that's going on right now.
These hybrids or these transgenic beings, they started a long time ago. Now they're adults now, and they're with us, evidently.
That's the subject of the whole second half of the book. Are these people, at least some of them, existing on Earth amongst us, driving cars, holding jobs, eating at McDonald's or whatever, I don't know. Is that happening? And I feel there's definite evidence that it is happening to some extent. And we have many, many case reports in the book. I know it's probably the most controversial thing one could possibly bring up, but I stuck my neck out, but I believe that this is in fact going on.
Is there any way you think we can tell who is who?
Well, that, Jerry, I don't know. You know,
do you think they even know?
That's another. That's a very interesting question, and that's there's a possibility there that there may be some confusion. I don't really know. These are the tough new questions. Every time you open a door in the subject, you found enough information to open the door. You find that there are a million more doors behind that, and a million more questions to ask. And what we're trying to do is to find the answers to these questions. And what you just asked is an excellent and very important question.
Bud Hopkins, the book is Sight Unseen. It's always a pleasure to see you, and have a nice trip back to New York City.
Thank you very much, Greg. Great to be with you again.
Always good to have you, and in person, it's a special delight.
We're doing a tribute to Bud Hopkins, who passed away on Sunday at the age of 80. Bud Hopkins first became interested in the UFO phenomenon when he and two others had a daylight UFO sighting near Touro, Massachusetts. That happened in 1964. In 1975, he carried out his first major investigation on UFOs and abductions. It involved a UFO landing and occupant incident in North Hudson Park, New Jersey. Shortly after he began to concentrate on the investigation of UFO abductions and that phenomenon, and it led to several publications. Shortly after that, he decided to concentrate on the investigation of UFO abductions, and that led to his eventual publication of many books. And several books, including The Intruders. About a decade ago, he founded that as a nonprofit organization, a foundation, the Intruders Foundation, to which he would dedicate his lifelong work in investigating the world of ET abductions, mainly. This is the first interview that we did with Bud Hopkins. It was at KBIX in Muskogee, and we apologize for the phone sound, but it was recorded a long time ago on some equipment that's pretty outdated by now. But I think you'll find it interesting, so we're going to play part of it. Here's Bud Hopkins talking to me for the first time.
The point is that we're used to putting an unknown, like the UFO occupants, into a God's or devil's category. Either here to help or they're here to hurt. And that's the way we kind of want to see things.
And from reading between the lines here, I think you think they're more benign.
Well, I'm saying that I don't think they're here to do either. They're not here to help, or they're not here to. Obviously, nobody did anything to prevent
a lot of things,
September 11th events, or for that matter, the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. All kinds of things,
and all sorts of horrors that have happened. And there's never been any sense that there was any kind of intervention that would be helpful to us.
And on your research over the years, and we'll get into The Intruders here in a moment, and I love that title. It's so appropriate. Did that come to you immediately, or did that just come?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. As with my new book that my wife Carol and I are working on, we don't have a real good title for it yet. And as with the other two books, I didn't have a title until I handed in the manuscript. And the title, Missing Time, which has, of course, become a kind of catchphrase in this, just like Alan Hynek's Close Encounters, that came at the very last minute when I handed in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So Interiors was just a very simple title. And what
To sum it up, they're not necessarily invaders.
Yeah,
and they're not necessarily saviors.
That's right.
And they're intruders.
Yeah, that's right. And uninvited. But you asked about where Copley Woods was. I changed the name of Copleywoods to protect the family. But it's another woods that sounds a lot like Copley, but I changed it, and it's in the suburbs of the city of Indianapolis. But one of the problems in doing this research is that the major weapon of the debunkers is not scientific evidence or any kind of rational attack on the material and the data, but it's actually the weapon of witness intimidation. If they can use enough ridicule and enough, just really attacking their credentials and so forth, the people who come forward, they can guarantee that the people who have the greatest credentials and who might be the most listened to by the public are going to be the very ones who won't come forward. And I've had, for instance, I've worked with abductees. One was a research scientist for NASA. I've worked with a number of police officers. I've worked with 8 psychiatrists who have come to me because of their own abductions. Army officers, people, well-known people in various fields, just plain folks, and so forth. But I can tell you that the higher a person is up the socioeconomic scale, the less likely that person is to come forward and present his testimony or her testimony.
I think this is a good place to break from that interview. We'll go back. There's some other interesting things on it. Once again, we apologize for the quality. But we, on that same series of shows we did every Friday night, we had Larry Dickin, our executive producer at the time, who was a good friend of Bud Hopkins and a member of the Intruders Foundation. Larry actually found one of the witnesses to one of the cases that Bud was investigating. And I thought it would be kind of interesting to play that interview, to play that right now.
Well, he's a little bit about what Bud told you about what this fellow said. He'll remain nameless. He used a name, but that wasn't his real name.
No. No, he's, I'm not even going to use any names at all.
And you mentioned something to me earlier when we were visiting about this, is that he's not necessarily so afraid of prison time or something like that, but he'll lose all his benefits.
Yeah, I get the impression that this individual is either close to retirement in the military or has already retired recently, and that's the reason he's come forth with this. However, he certainly wouldn't want any links back to him, because that's the one thing that the government could do great harm to him with, is to take away his retirement benefits. So I think that's one of his main reasons for keeping silent. And certainly we want to honor that. So the information that I'm going to tell you is basically what Bud told me.
So he had this this appearance by this Air Force officer.
Right.
He was stationed on a SAC base, a Strategic
right.
Air Command.
This is what happened. This was back in 1965 or 6, I believe. Bud said 65, but it was either that or 66. And the location I cannot reveal, because that would help pin this person down. But it was a SAC base. It was somewhere out in the middle of the country. And there were a number of people involved in this sighting. This was not one person or two people reporting a UFO flying over a SAC base. This was a close encounter, basically of the third kind. This is spacecraft, UFOs approaching personnel in the Air Force. I get the impression that these people were, probably like Air Force security people. They were actually guarding the airplanes out on the field, because these planes contain nuclear weapons. In order to have this job, you have to have, basically a top secret clearance, if not above. And so there was a large contingent of people. The exact number I'm unsure of, but I'm guessing that you're talking maybe 20 to 30 individuals involved in this sighting. And what they reported is that in the distance they saw a number of lights heading very rapidly towards the airbase, and starting off at a fairly high altitude and descending. They got to the end of the runway, these lights, and they could start discerning that there were shapes, and these were apparently disc-shaped craft with lighting on the edges and on the bottom. And the craft came along the runway, approached the parked B-52 bombers with weapons aboard, and they were hovering at an altitude of several feet, and I'm talking here, you know, 2 to 3 feet off of the ground, off of the runway, in between the planes.
Now, do we have any idea how big these saucer-shaped craft are?
They're pretty, quote, standard size for the small disc-shaped craft, about 30 feet in diameter. And
now, did the security forces fire on this craft? You know, George Feiler told the story about seeing security forces at McGuire Air Force Base shoot and kill an alien one time, or an extraterrestrial.
Well, yes, indeed, they did fire upon the craft. In other words, these are unknown craft making an obvious security breach on a SAC base. And their job is to protect the aircraft and the nuclear weapons. So, indeed, they did open fire on the UFOs. And this is all taking place in a relatively dark environment. Bud pointed out to me that the only light out on the field, because these planes were parked, you know, this was late at night, you know, there's always planes, you know, on rotation for duty, especially back in the 60s, you know, they had these things taking off and they'd stay in the air for 24 hours and they would rotate. But the planes were, you know, this was the middle of the night. You're dealing with basically a dark runway area. Mm-hmm. The only lighting was from the flashlights of the team members here, the security team members.
So the saucer craft weren't lit?
No, they were. And the lighting from the craft themselves.
Okay.
All right. When they opened fire on the craft, this is one of the more interesting aspects of this story, is they had tracer bullets, so they could actually see where the bullets were going. And as they were firing, they noticed that the bullets did not ricochet off the side of the craft, you know, or penetrate. They literally bent around the craft itself. It's almost like there was a gravitational field there that was so strong that it was changing the flight path of the bullets.
A magnetic sponge.
Or something.
Well, you know, I've heard many reports, you know, from people who have studied these things that evidently these saucers, UFOs, for lack of a better term, because they're not all saucers anymore. We have triangles, flying triangles, cigar shapes, all kinds of shapes.
Mm-hmm.
They have something to do with gravity. I mean, manipulating it. I mean, they can go from a standing start to, you know, like we always kid about Star Trek, hitting warp speed or something.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense if you stop and think about it, about
right.
The bullets just kind of getting sponged off and thrown away.
Right. So as far as these craft were concerned, they were under attack. But they were totally able to defend themselves.
I guess it was Debrief City after that.
Right. And there was no response, incidentally. In other words, even though these people are there, if you can imagine a firefight, you know, with 20 or 30 personnel all firing machine guns at the same time, it must have been quite a show. But there was no response from the UFOs other than the fact that it eventually they just departed the area. And afterwards, as you were saying, I'm sure that, you know, all these personnel were debriefed and they were given a cover story, which was they had been participating in an experiment involving hallucinatory drugs, which they had all been given earlier in the evening. And that's the reason they saw, or they thought they saw, what they did.
And this happened in 66?
Yes.
Once again, Bud Hopkins on the subject of changing names.
So I have to do a lot of concealing of names and changing names, which I always specify that I'm doing that. And because the location of this person's in Intruders, Kitley Woods, as I called it, because the house had behind it this circle where the ground was sort of baked into a hard, almost rock-like substance and would not support grass, I was afraid that if I gave the actual name of the area, people would be driving around looking, poking around people's backyards.
Yeah, well, you're right. And probably in Indianapolis and that area, that wouldn't be, if you described it thoroughly, it probably wouldn't be that hard to locate.
That's the point. So I changed the name of the, I came up with Copley, partly because I'm a painter and Copley is a... He's a very fine early 19th century American painter.
Now before we get off here, Bud Hopkins, I got to find out what you paint. What do you do? Still life? Landscape?
No, I'm an abstract painter.
Okay.
And I paint, well, the work has had a long evolution, of course. I've been around for a long time. I had my first show, believe it or not, in 1956. When I first came to New York, I was involved with the abstract expressionist movement, which is essentially Jackson Pollock.
What would it cost for me to get a painting from you? I mean, any kind of one to buy. Do you have a gallery?
Yeah, right. I just had a show in Los Angeles, a three-person show, and just had a show here, East Coast.
I want you to realize first, before you answer that question, Bud, that I'm not trying to put a value on talent at all. I'm just trying to give the listener
The price range would be, I make some very small collages, which would be $400, something like that. Yeah. And the big paintings could be $12,000 and $15,000.
And do you have a separate location for the gallery? Is it located?
No, it's I show it commercial galleries. No, but I actually my studio's in my building that I live in.
Okay. Now, we were talking a little bit about the situation in Indianapolis, right outside Indianapolis, for the intruders. What about those visitations? Was something in that that stood out or jumped out?
This was extremely crude new information, because from the very beginning of our knowledge of the abduction phenomenon, back to Betty Barney Hill case, we were aware that there was a... let's say, reproductive aspect of the aliens' interest in human beings. And Betty Hill, a needle being placed in her navel, and she was told it was very painful. She was told it was a pregnancy test, which, of course, doesn't make any sense. And this was, incidentally, long before amniocentesis was developed, which is quite interesting because now it's a very routine thing for doctors to take the amniotic fluid by going in through the navel, but that was only an alien technique back in 61 when that happened.
During the past week or so, we came across a lost Betty Hill tape, and I thought since Bud Hopkins was talking about Betty Hill in this interview, this would be a good time to play this tape. I don't know who the guy is that's interviewing her, but it's a very interesting tape. It's about an encounter that happened in September of 1961. Listen closely.
Yep.
And what? Give me some...
Actually, what led to the food was the examiner came running back into the room where I was and started tugging at my teeth. And he wanted to know why Barney's teeth were removable and mine were not.
And the story is Barney had dentures.
Yeah, during World War II, Barney got too close to a hand grenade and knocked his teeth out.
And they were totally confused by
that
all of this.
That was very puzzling to them.
And humorous.
Yeah.
Any other instances that something that, as a human, you took so general as a characteristic that you never thought of it, that they got confused by, almost childlike, you know, akin to the denture incident? Yeah. Was there anything else like that they seemed that, boy, you don't know that? That you can recall?
Well, they were sort of disappointed. I didn't know anything about the solar system.
Okay.
That, I think they really expected me to be able to identify the map.
They were actually upset that you didn't recognize their home. Let's go to that. Marjorie Fish, months later, or years later, actually.
Years later.
Under hypnosis. Tries to induce you under hypnosis to redraw that story.
No,
maybe you can go over that.
Dr. Simon, at the time.
Benjamin Simon.
Dr. Benjamin Simon said that during the week, if I wanted to, I would be able to remember the star map, and I would sketch it. But I was not to think about it. I was just to let my hands go ahead and draw it, which I did. And that was in 1965.
Four years after the incident.
Now, in 1969, Marjorie Fish came here and stayed a few days and asked me all kinds of questions, hours and hours, which she taped. And then used that to go back home and
took your map,
did the research on it, and identified the areas.
The area of the star map, which she said was in the constellation that we know, Reticulus, in the star system, was Zeta Reticuli. And from that point, do you remember them mentioning Zeta Reticuli, or is that a terminology that we, as Earthlings, have given them? So
I would have no idea what their name is for their home planet.
And do you remember what type of star system? Was it a white star? Was it a yellow star? A red giant? Do you recall what type of star or anything?
I don't know, but I do know that our astronomers believe that the stars on my map were the ones most likely to have planets and have life, as we know it.
And so they may be younger stars, hotter stars.
Actually, we're believed to be 4.6 billion years old.
Or 20 billion. It seems that age a billion years every 5 years. So.
But actually, Zeta Reticuli, we believe, this is a belief. We don't know for sure. But we believe it's about 11 billion years old. So they've been around a lot longer than we have.
Over twice as long than the chance to evolutionize, to project. So, this puzzling incident, you're examined, you get a tour of the spaceship or the craft. Did they show you anything? It's just only on a need-to-know basis.
Just the one room I was in.
The interaction with you and the question-and-answer session was more than Barney. They did not give Barney the opportunity to inquire.
No, there was no conversation with Barney. I enjoyed myself. I had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
He joked. We kidded.
Really?
Yeah. I invited him to come back. Like I said, please, please, please come back. Oh, I had so many friends who would love to meet you.
So this was not a traumatic experience at all. It was an enlightening experience.
Oh,
spiritually uplifting,
right,
perhaps.
Right. It was. Nobody can tell me there's not life on other planets.
At the same time, it seems that 36 hours after the sighting is on record, according to Jacques Ballet, at 2:14 a.m., Pease Air Force was tracking an unknown object.
Oh, yeah, I told him that. Pease Air Force Base released the radar report where they tracked this craft. It's like two planes out to check it out, and the reports of the pilots are still classified, so we know they just saw it.
To the skeptic, that kind of knocks them out of the water, then, if for you to guess... If this were a concocted story, boy, you know your stuff. It's a pretty well orchestrated event to have Pease personnel involved, and that Betty and Barney, Barney was a postal worker.
Yeah.
Postal worker, you're involved in real estate, and that you pulled off a grand hoax through the Air Force. It's nearly impossible, if not impossible, absurd, I guess is the term I'm looking for. You're released from the craft. You get back into the car. You check your watches. Why?
Well, I don't think we checked our watches until we're almost home to see what time it was, and both our watches had stopped functioning.
And you could not account for some time elapsed?
No, the trip, we realized the trip had taken much longer than what it should have. Maybe about 2 hours.
Were you feeling woozy? Did you have a headache? Did you have any physical? Were you just exhausted? What can you describe what your feeling was?
We've been driving all night. We got home about 5 in the morning. We're calm. We're relaxed.
Oh, so you weren't...
Feeling very well.
You didn't feel traumatized or injured at any time or should I say, violated at that time. Okay. You go in the house, and I guess, is it the next morning? You check out the car and
finds...
And what happens when you look at the car?
Highly polished spots on the trunk of the car.
Highly...
And that day, we were getting tropical rains from a hurricane that was going through. And it was heavy downpour. And didn't affect spots at all. They stayed there for months.
Your sister, who claimed to have seen a UFO, suggested that you do what with around the car?
She talked to a physicist who said go out with a compass and check out the spots, which we did.
What happened?
And the compass was very, very erratic.
Almost spinning or just...
Yeah, it was, and we tried it on different other parts of the car, and it didn't react that
But way. Just near where the spots were.
Just the spots.
Hence the inference being a magnetic anomaly. Yeah. Something was really distorting the magnetic draw of the compass. Yeah. At that point, afterwards, do you contact Kufos, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, or what is the sequence of events?
No.
Just Walter Webb?
First of all, we didn't do anything.
Okay.
And then NICAP in Washington.
Okay.
I wrote to them because I wanted to know, being exposed to a UFO, close range, was there any health problems? Were we exposed to radiation? What kind of dangers?
They dispatched Walter Webb as their representative.
That was later.
Okay, okay. So NICAP has that. That letter winds up on the files of the Center for UFO Studies with Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
It might have. I don't know.
You never, ever communicated with Dr. Hynek.
Oh, yeah. We became good friends.
Oh, really?
That was years later.
Okay.
We did numerous TV programs together.
Okay. What was your feeling on Dr. Hynek? Was he obviously a thinly veiled skeptic?
Oh, no. He believed every word of it.
At the end?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, as soon as he met us.
Sure. I think that his take on the UFO phenomena when he was humiliated with the swamp gas incident to trot out an absurd explanation for an event in front of a college dorm, I believe, in Michigan or near the Great Lakes. That's when he said, all right, enough, that he saw that the government was masquerading or at least trotting out disinformation and misinformation on the UFO phenomena.
Because when he first started, he was working for the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So... Dr. Hynek and you were great friends then?
Oh, yeah.
Great.
And I believe Dr. Hynek's son, there's a son who lives, used to, I don't know about now, you live down here in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. So, you're having some troubling dreams now. Is that what happens at home?
Oh.
After the encounter?
10 nights after this happened, I had a series of dreams for 5 nights. Each dream was different. Which later I found out was a recall of what had happened.
In the dreams, you were depicting what you just described to me. At that point, what do you do? Is Barney troubled by all of this? Is Barney...
No.
Has his life pattern changed? Has his mood changed at all? Or
actually...
Any physical...
The first thing that I did was each morning, during the next day, I wrote down what I could remember of my dream.
The following day, which would be the 20th.
And every time I had it, no, I didn't.
I'm sorry, 10 days,
nights,
right? Sure.
After.
So we're talking the 29th, 30th, roughly.
Yeah. And I made a record on these
38
dreams.
Years to the day. Okay.
And
sure.
Then I took and put them away. Mm-hmm. And then later, several months later, I talked with my supervisor about the meaning of dreams.
And
then she said, well, maybe it happened.
And suggested, or did she connect you with
some? We just talked about it.
Barney Hill, even that was never mentioned in a book, had had a
a sperm sample taken from him when he was on the examining table in the UFO. So we knew about this, that there was that reproductive interest. But what happened was in 1983, as I was investigating this Indianapolis case, a woman I called Kathy Davis, it turned out that she began speaking very emotionally about the fact that she had had a pregnancy, which was very unusual that she had gotten pregnant. She had not been sexually active hardly at all, and that the pregnancy disappeared, and that those two events were connected, the getting pregnant and having the pregnancy disappear, were connected with certain memories she had of a UFO aspect of some kind of incident. But she also had this extremely vivid memory, or a dream, she wasn't sure, of being shown at some later point a small child. And the small child, she was told, was hers, and that it was not fully human. It was a mix of herself and the aliens. And, of course, all of this sounded outrageous, and yet all along I had been getting reports from people suggesting that ova and sperm samples were being routinely taken.
Well, now, do you think that, did she have some missing time where she had...
Oh, yes.
...actually gave the birth to the baby, or was the baby taken out of the womb?
The baby was removed at some point, probably in the third trimester. The third month of the first trimester. And she had no bleeding and no sense of a miscarriage, but she knew in the morning that she was no longer pregnant, and found out, in fact, she was no longer pregnant. And I began to find...
Well, do you think it's some kind of Hitler complex for a super race, or do you think they just can't reproduce?
Well, again, we don't know. The fact that this is going on, that they're doing this, seems to me beyond doubt at this point, but as to what the motives are and what their problems are, we can only speculate.
But do you got any idea what happens to the babies? Do they stay with the spaceships?
Yes, exactly. They stay with the craft. We also have a lot of reason to believe that many of these, let's say, genetically engineered mixes are not working out. In other words, there are serious problems with
why do you raise that? That's an interesting statement. Why do you say that?
Well, people have been shown infants that seem to be, the phrase, babies that don't thrive. In other words, they seem to be filled with lassitude, quiet, they don't look healthy, they don't seem to move much. Sometimes people have been shown babies that are quite deformed, as if certain aspects of their bodies have not developed normally. And it would seem that whatever this program is, that it's not some kind of absolutely efficient...
Even though this race of extraterrestrials probably is far advanced of us...
Yeah.
They've got the problem that it just doesn't...
Doesn't take every time.
You're right. It's in other words, that's a pretty scary thought there. What happens to these children, I wonder?
Yeah, and also, exactly. And also, numerous people have described being in a craft and taken into a room and showed, and they were shown things that looked like tanks, incubating tanks in which developing fetuses were floating. And
maybe it's just as simple as they should allow them to stay in their human host till full term. I wonder why they don't.
The interesting thing is that the UFO occupants seem to feel that there's something magical about human touch and about the maternal instinct. And if you look at it this way, if you can imagine that, and this is pure speculation, that the alien race, whatever they are, have not had to reproduce in the normal way for centuries or whatever, and that all their offspring are produced in vitro. In other words, they're all test tube babies, mm-hmm. or whatnot. If that's the case, then the maternal instinct might have atrophied and
it would disappear from
the sexual instinct, and therefore, because we have such really powerful maternal and paternal feelings for our children, and of course we have such strong sexual instincts for one another, that maybe these are qualities which they want to reintroduce in their particular evolutionary position, wherever they are. I mean, this is speculation, but something like that may be very possible.
You know, following that line of speculation along, then this race could be very old chronologically.
Well, certainly their technology is incredibly advanced over ours.
Mm-hmm.
But then,
I was thinking more of the inhabitants themselves. What are the little grays, or are the different types of people?
Well, the gray figures are I've always said they're about 85% of the reports are of the gray figures. And even when we get reports, as in the Travis Walton case, of very human-looking figures who seem quite, well-constructed and handsome and so forth, they're actually right there with grays cooperating, doing the same thing together.
Yeah. I've had Travis on two or three times over the years.
Wonderful guy.
Uh-huh.
Well, you see, in terms of evil, I mean, one has to assume the possibility that the ultimate goal here is it's not going to be a happy outcome for human beings. I mean, that is certainly a very logical reading of the data as we have it. You see, we're not getting right now any sense that they are deliberately hurting people. In other words, if they take a child out of the bed and at night, and the child is extremely frightened and put on a table and examined and poked and prodded and so forth, they do something to reassure the child that they won't be hurt and they'll be taken back and so forth, and the child is tucked back in bed. And incidentally, I should point out that sometimes the child is put back wearing somebody else's pajamas.
Really? Now, I hadn't heard that before, Bud.
Well, I've got many cases where a person is abducted at night, we'll say, and obviously they're then stripped inside the ship for the examination and these procedures. And if there are a number of people in the ship, sometimes that they get one another's clothes on by mistake.
So in other words, these people may be advanced, but they still are capable of bungling.
Oh, absolutely. There are many, many, many bungles. People are put back in the wrong beds, in the wrong rooms in the houses, or even sometimes in the wrong house. They're put, the car is put down and one case, after a car had been taken, lifted up, it was put down in the middle of a field with some trees around, and there was no way for the car to get out of the field. They had to cut down a couple of trees, which was made the point.
Now, the debunkers would have problems with that one.
Yeah, but they all come up with something. See, if you're a true believer, as these debunkers are, you'll find a reason. You'll say, maybe it was never put down there that way, and the people just lied, or something. They'll come up with something, because they have to defend their ideology, and they will do anything. Some of them, at least.
You're talking about the debunkers.
The debunkers, yes.
To make sure their theory works.
Yeah, that this is not accepted. Of course, what we're asking, I was incidentally gave a lecture once in Westchester County, and I was contacted by a man who said he was from the Westchester Skeptical Society, and he invited me to come and debate with him. And I said, I don't do debates. I said, I don't go and debate. I said, we've been having nothing but debates over all these years, and it hasn't gotten us anywhere. But I said, I'll tell you what I will do. I said, if you have a psychiatrist who is a skeptic or whatever in your group, and he's interested in actually investigating a case with me from whatever premise he wants to operate from, I said, let him get in touch with me, and we'll look into it together. I said, let's do a joint investigation. Let's not do sitting trying to, make debaters' points against one another.
Westchester Skeptical Society.
And they never replied to me.
Yeah, they were skeptical.
they don't want to do an investigation.
Sure, I understand what you're saying.
They want to sit there and tell you all the points why this can't be. This can't be because You can't get here from there, wherever there is, and you can't travel in space, and aliens wouldn't look like this, and et cetera, et cetera. They have a list of things. And in other words, they're arguing from the point of view of theory, and they're trying to make their theories refute our data.
Has anything downright comical ever come up?
Well,
the reason I ask that is, you're talking about the pajamas being on the wrong.
Well, that we have one there that was a woman, actually, she was just listening here this past weekend, and she lived in Ohio at the time, and she had bought a new nightgown. She was very proud of a Victoria's Secret nightgown. And she went to bed, and she woke up in the morning knowing that something had happened. She had dim memories, typical kind of fragment of memories. And she realized she was wearing some big, bulky, green man's T-shirt.
I'd like to see the man.
Which made out the man was wearing when he woke up.
Who said that this research business is all dull?
Well, but funny things do happen sometimes.
I was living in Baltimore at the time, and I was visiting my girlfriend. I was driving home from Frederick. On Route 40, I saw lights starting to follow my car. They came down out of the sky. It was very late at night. They then flew off. It scared me very badly, of course. And the next thing I knew is my car was ripped off, literally ripped off the side of the road, the highway. And I thought I was going to crash. The next thing I remember is I must have hit my head or blacked out or something, because I remember sort of staggering out of the car, climbing up, sort of staggering around to the right side of the car. I was off the highway at this point. And there was a bright light in front of me. And I looked to the right, and there were five little guys. I was led into a saucer, for lack of a better word. And I was led into a room, and some sort of an operation was performed on me. I thought that I was somehow a little bit different, maybe a little unusual, maybe singled out because, for example, I was in very good health. I was a professional athlete. In retrospect, I don't think any of those things were the reason. I think my feeling is that it was very random, that I was in the wrong place.
That was one of Bud Hopkins' investigations and one of his witnesses. Larry Dickin came across another one of Bud Hopkins' witnesses. And I think you'll find this part of the show very interesting. Listen carefully.
My guest, his name is Robert Freulenstedt, and Gary, just call him Robert or Bob.
Okay.
Bob.
Can I call you Bob?
Yes, Bob.
Okay, Bob. Okay.
And
or do you call him Robert, Larry? What do you call him?
Bob.
Okay, we'll call him Bob.
And I tell you, it's quite an interesting story, because many, many years ago, in fact, in 1979, Bob's father had an experience in North Hudson Park here in New Jersey. Now, North Hudson Park is right next to the Hudson River, and it was the location of a very famous sighting that was Bud Hopkins' first reported UFO incident. That's what got Bud interested in UFOs and started him on his career as a UFO investigator. And this was the 1975 sighting in North Hudson Park that involved a UFO actually landing in the park. It was observed by a number of people, including a doorman at an apartment on the east side of the park, and also by a person driving in a car through the park, saw the UFO land, and little gray aliens got out, took some soil samples, got back in the craft, and took off. Now, Bud and I had a conversation last week, and I introduced Bud to Robert, and Bud and Robert have had an extensive conversation on this particular event, and it does involve missing time and an abduction, but this is not the same event as in 1975. It just happens to be in the same location. This occurred in 1979. And Bud informed me, and I was somewhat aware of this anyway, that North Hudson Park seems to attract UFOs for some reason. There have been a number of incidents reported in the park since 1975, and the last one I can remember was in the mid-1980s. There were a number of incidents reported there, and they probably still continue today. So, given that introductory information, Jerry, I'm going to turn you over to Robert, and he's going to tell you his story as related to him by his father, and you can take it from there.
Okay, Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jerry.
And I guess you and Larry have known each other for a while, and then all of a sudden he became aware of this only recently, huh?
Exactly.
So you don't necessarily run around telling people this story all the time.
No, not usually.
Why don't you let our listeners in on exactly, you start where you want, and let's just go ahead and tell us the story.
Well, it was 1979, and I was 13, going on 14. And my father was coming home from work, and he was driving on Boulevard East, which is right adjacent with the Hudson River. And he turned off into the park, which is North Hudson Park.
And how big of a park is this for our listeners? It's pretty extensive, isn't it?
It's a big park. It takes up, I think, around 5 blocks.
Okay.
It's a big park. And it's right across from the Hudson River, so it's the view of Manhattan. And a lot of large high-rises around it. And he was driving to the park, and he says his car stopped. And he saw this big bright light on top of his car. And then there was something in front of the car, like some kind of a ship. And all he really remembers was his radio went dead, and he kind of heard some strange things on the radio. Not sure what it was.
He never really told you what the strange things were. I mean, the different kind of language.
No, he kind of said it was like a language he didn't understand, you know. Mm-hmm. And what he only really remembers is this ship in front of him, and the top of it opened, and he saw what you call now a grays, a little guy with big eyes. And then it shut and basically took off, which he felt was like 10 minutes, if that. But he got home like 3 hours later, figuring it was just 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's pretty common in that. So he was gone for that long period of time, so obviously he was abducted.
Yeah, that's what we would think, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now when he got home and told this story, of course we all thought he was crazy. You know, I was only 13, but my mother wasn't sure what was going on, you know. And he thought he was nuts, too. He didn't want the story to get out. He didn't want people to know about it, you know. That night or the night after, he started having these dreams. Weird enough, it was about the Miss America pageant, which was 1979. And he had these dreams, and he felt like it was real, like it was like he was there. Now, he named the winner that year, which was Cheryl Pruitt, 1979, what state she was from, what she looked like, what color dress she was wearing, what song she sang. I mean, every detail possible. And
I wonder if you watched it on television.
Well, we did. We had friends over that night, and we were all watching it on television. Mm-hmm. And no one really took it seriously until she actually sang the song and wore the dress and came out and actually won that year. You know, he has no affiliation with the Miss America contest, you know.
That's pretty interesting, isn't it? I mean, do you guys feel, and did your father feel that he was transported down there, or does he have any theory?
I don't think he really discussed about a theory he had about it. You know, it was just basically.
Jerry, if I can interject here, it's not uncommon that abductees report that after their abductions, they seem to have heightened. Quote, psychic powers of various kinds, some of which is the ability to predict future events.
And of course, we theorized this before, Robert, that maybe they actually were into the future and back. That's some of the time travel theories involved in these things. I'm not sure that Larry or I buy into that, but it is common, isn't it, Larry?
Yes, it is.
So he was able to tell you anything about this Miss America pageant. You watched it on television. Everything he said was correct.
Everything. He said his dreams felt like he was actually there. You know, he even told us what he wore. You know, it was like, it felt like he was actually there. Boy, he had everything on the money.
Boy, it would have been weird if they'd showed a shot of the audience, and there he was.
Yeah, it would have been a little startling. But, yeah, and I definitely feel it has something to do with the whole sighting, you know, whether it was an abduction or whatever you want to call it. But
How long was he missing?
He, like I said, he was supposed to be home at a certain time. He came home 3 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
But he felt it was 10 minutes. He had no idea what time it was when he got home.
So he was astounded when your mother said, "Well, where have you been?"
Well, she was basically waiting up, you know, worried where he was. And that's basically the situation when he walked in 3 hours late, and that was his story.
Now, when he had these dreams that were so realistic, you lived in the same household. I mean, did he make noises or anything about that?
While he was dreaming?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
I mean,
okay,
you know,
just curious.
I was in the room, but I don't think so. But basically, he just told the story, the dream he had when he woke up, you know. And that was it. He felt it was weird. He felt it was worth mentioning because it was different than any other dreams he had. It felt like he was actually there.
Did your father say during this time that when he was stopped there at the park? I guess it was no other traffic, just him with the spotlight and the UFO in front of him.
Yeah, he doesn't recall any other traffic.
And he does remember the little gray coming out. But to him, it seems like it just came out and went back in.
That's what it seems like, yeah. That's all he remembers was the top of the ship opening up and seeing the gray and then closing again.
Interesting, Larry.
Yes.
It's certainly interesting. I wonder, thinking about this, did your father remember more later on, or was this just basically all he said about it?
No, that was basically all he said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't really more than that.
So that's an interesting thing. And that's in Hudson Park?
In North Hudson Park.
And that's about, 150 miles from Atlantic City?
Yeah. Yeah, it's about 150 miles.
Yeah, I mean,
it's right across the river from Manhattan. It's
sure.
10 minutes out of Manhattan.
Sure, sure. So, I mean... the Miss America pageant. That's an interesting twist. I haven't heard that before.
No.
Well, Larry Dickin, what do you think about it all?
Well, one other fact I'd like to throw in here real quick is the fact that, you know, when his father came home and told his wife and Robert about his experience... you know, he's saying, you know, I'm wondering if, you know, I'm the only person that saw this, or, you know, did anybody else see this? And, so the next day they checked the, newspapers, and specifically, paper that was published back then is called the Hudson County Dispatch, which is now a part of the Jersey Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And in the paper, there was an article that indeed reported this UFO incident, not particularly talking about him. This was another eyewitness observer, or perhaps several of them, in the area of the park did indeed see a UFO come down and land in the park. So that confirmed that the sighting, you know, was a real thing. Several people saw this craft. But he is the one that had the personal abduction experience.
Bob, has anything happened to you personally?
No, not to me personally.
Well, has Larry explained to you that some of these times these things run in the family?
Yeah, he has. I'm still waiting.
Well, it's interesting, and of course that fact about it being backed up would be a newspaper article, Larry, and then the Miss America angle. This is a unique story for sure, Bob. We appreciate it.
Yes, and Bud, as I said, is following up on this, and you know, if there's any way to get in touch, you know, with the actual eyewitness here and have him get together with Bud and do some regression therapy, it might prove to be some meat for a future book.
Yep. Okay.
So, you know, we'll be looking forward to hearing from Bud and what he has to say about this.
And, of course, Bud will be on this show again in August.
Right, August the... 9th. he's scheduled to be on the show. Now, I think it'll probably be premature to ask him about this particular case at that point in time, but if something arises, then he'll certainly bring it up then.
Well, Robert?
Yes.
Thank you very much for being candid with us and telling us about that.
You're welcome.
And let us know. We want to be the first to know when you have your personal experience, if you ever do.
I sure will.
Okay.
It was a pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Larry?
So Bud Hopkins will be missed. He passed away at 80 on Sunday afternoon. And much of his work still lives on thanks to his many books and many lectures and all of his research with the IntrudersFoundation.org. You might check that website out. Bud Hopkins will live on for some time thanks to his work and especially his books, The Intruders. It was a pioneer book on the abduction, and it actually got widespread distribution, including in many libraries all over the country, making all of a sudden the subject of ET abductions more valid for millions. Other books included The Brooklyn Bridge Incident and Missing Time. There were others as well, including an autobiography by Bud about himself and his art and his UFO research, his fascination with the UFO story. Bud Hopkins, we will miss you, but your work will live on. This has been a tribute to Bud Hopkins. I'm Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. Until next time, cheers.